Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Norman Solomon, co-founder of the online activist group RootsAction.org, who assesses the Trump administration's recent missile strike in Syria in response to the alleged April 7th Syrian chemical weapons attack on civilians. Energy security strategist Jill Gordis, who discusses the concept of distributed energy that promotes the creation of decentralized redundant electricity systems, mostly powered by renewable energy. And Alex Lawson, executive director of Social Security Works, who examines the decades-long effort by the Republican Party to raise the eligibility age and reduce benefits for recipients of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Two Reuters journalists in Myanmar are going to trial for violating the Southeast Asian nation's Colonial-Era Official Secrets Act. The reporters Chow Saw-Oo and Wa Lon had investigated the massacre of 10 Rohingya civilians by Myanmar soldiers in the village of In Dinh. The incident occurred in the midst of a violent crackdown against members of the Muslim Rohingya minority by soldiers and Buddhist villagers. During the violence, over 700,000 Rohingya fled across the border into Bangladesh. The reporters had uncovered two photographs of 10 victims kneeling with their hands tied behind their backs before being executed. They also discovered mass graves where the villagers were buried. Only hours before a judge ordered the reporters to be put on trial, the army announced four officers and three soldiers in the Myanmar army were sentenced to 10 years of hard labor for their roles in the massacre. Yet the reporters, who were charged with violating the Official Secrets Act, face a 14-year prison sentence. The ruling ordering the trial of the two Reuters journalists was criticized by members of the independent Myanmar Press Council, who insist that the judiciary is caving into pressure from the military, whose leaders are upset about the investigative reporters uncovering grave human rights crimes committed by the army. In the final days of the 2016 presidential election, swing voters were bombarded with online anti-Muslim ads funded by right-wing hedge fund billionaire Robert Mercer. One of the ads warned that Syrian refugees have taken over America against the backdrop of an image of the Statue of Liberty covered in a burqa. Although the anti-Muslim ads did not support or oppose a specific candidate, they echoed Donald Trump's anti-Muslim rhetoric during the 2016 campaign. The online ads seen on Google and Facebook were purchased by a little-known right-wing group called Secure America Now that has no paid employees or volunteers. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, the group is funded by a handful of wealthy donors, including Mercer, Ronald Lauder, and executives linked with the consumer electronics store Best Buy. Bloomberg News concluded the ads were seen by millions of voters, and Facebook reportedly developed 12 different versions of the anti-Muslim ads to test which was the most popular and effective with impressionable swing voters. Neither the IRS nor the Federal Election Commission is expected to investigate the actions of Secure America Now, so it appears that the dark money outfit will continue to try to sway American elections without government sanction or scrutiny. Food stamps, officially known as SNAP, the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, often serves as a bridge for low-wage workers during intermittent periods of unemployment. Food stamps assist 40 million Americans a month to avoid hunger by supplementing paychecks to purchase groceries. Many low-wage working parents endure irregular schedules, working nights and weekends, causing them to have difficulty finding childcare. When low-income workers, who often have very few basic benefits, get sick, they're penalized and lose wages. A new study by the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities suggests SNAP recipients are usually only temporarily unemployed and quickly find new jobs. More than half of adult SNAP recipients will work sometime during any given month. The report's findings go against a common narrative that poor people use SNAP for long periods of time in lieu of working. But the Trump administration and House Republicans are working to fundamentally change the program by expanding work requirements and limiting eligibility through harsh asset tests. SNAP participants must already register for work and accept jobs if offered. The study found that work requirements are less effective at shifting people into work than offering voluntary job training. However, the current Congress is unlikely to fund the costs of such training programs. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In the aftermath of reports that the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad had launched a chemical weapons attack on the rebel-held town of Douma, killing more than 70 civilians, the U.S., France, and Britain responded with a joint missile strike against several purported Syrian chemical weapons facilities. The attack came days before inspectors of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons could reach the site to investigate claims of the chemical attack. The U.S. air assault was carried out without congressional authorization. While President Trump applauded the missile strike with a tweet that read, "Mission accomplished," Syrian President Assad and Russian President Vladimir Putin denounced the attack as an act of aggression against a sovereign state. Russia is Syria's most important military ally in the nation's seven-year civil war that has claimed more than 400,000 lives. Your reporter spoke with Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org and founding director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. Here he assesses the U.S. media and Trump administration response to the alleged Syrian chemical weapons attack and the urgent need for diplomacy to end the brutal conflict in Syria.
What was accomplished was a lot of applause from mainline media in the United States, most of whom have been very negative towards President Trump, often for good reasons. But a lot of the critics, whether it's at MSNBC or the New York Times or Washington Post, who have been very down on a lot of things that Trump has done, really saluted. They applauded. They said how great it was that the president would take action in this military way, much pressure to do more. And that's something that unfortunately has become a sort of a repetition compulsion disorder by the mass media, to promote and push military action, usually not authorized by Congress, but egged on and pushed for by the mass media. And that was the case here. Other than that, what was accomplished was to keep the ball rolling for more killing in various directions in Syria. I don't think there's a case that can be made that sending missiles into Syria is going to reduce the killing. On the contrary, the more you put fuel on the fire, and people suffer and die.
Norman, one of the major issues that really is not being addressed by the Trump administration, nor the Obama administration before it, was the slaughter of hundreds of thousands, upwards of more than 400,000 civilians have been killed in this war since 2011. It seems like the United States and much of the rest of the world is just standing aside and not taking action, except in this instance of alleged use of chemical weapons. Seems like we're losing sight of the bigger priority here.
Well, a lot of people in the United States sincerely want the United States to intervene. They feel you've got to do something. The question is what? And often the idea, oh, we've got to do something, is more about us than about the situation in reality. It's sort of self-therapy, so we'll feel better about it. We're not being inactive. The U.S. has been involved shipping weapons through the CIA to various groups, often terrorist groups, by the description of the State Department, end up with some of those weapons. Nobody can really keep a straight scorecard on these morphing groups, often jihadist groups in Syria, so-called opposition, rebel opposition. There was a phrase even coined a couple of years ago, I think seriously, Scott, the moderate extremists, was one description of some of the factions involved in trying to overthrow the Syrian government. And to me, the clearest and most sensible and most humane position is to oppose all the killing from all directions. And I would condemn the Assad government. I would condemn the rebels who have been killing people. I would condemn Russia and the United States for sending in weapons and egging on and making more and more this of a proxy war with more and more slaughter. The pressure in the United States, though, is for the U.S. to up the ante. And after all, as U.S. citizens, or at least people who live inside the borders of the United States, we can't have a big effect on other governments, but theoretically, we have, in a democracy, effect on our own.
Norman, one thing that I think strikes the chords of many Americans' hearts and people across the world is seeing children particularly suffering with this alleged chemical attack. And then you have the response of our media, as you described, egging on a military response. We have inspectors from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW. Their mission is to go and inspect the site and see what was responsible for the deaths of these some 70 people in the village of Douma. What should have been the U.S. response here, if any, on the allegations that chemical weapons were used against important international treaties?
Well, even if you want to shoot, you first find out the facts. And it was really bass-ackwards, avowedly, and cheered on by the U.S. mass media, the White House acknowledging, at least to some degree, acknowledging, well, we don't have the facts, we don't really know for sure what happened there. Was there a chemical weapons attack, which it looks like there probably was? Who perpetrated it? We don't know, but we'll fire in some missiles anyway. I mean, this is just absolutely backwards to the most sensible, elementary way that one would proceed, even if you thought that you would help the situation by sending missiles into the country. OPCW is an organization that is in sync with the history of inspectors and international groups dominated by the United States, very politicized. We are in a sea of propaganda. We're drowning in it. I'm not going to sign up on any side in this conflict except finding peace, and that would require regional diplomacy. We hardly ever hear regional diplomacy or any diplomacy talked about seriously. It's often, if mentioned at all, just in the context of window dressing to try to gain some sense of PR advantage or credibility before the U.S. goes ahead and does what it wants to do anyway. But there's no way in hell that there's going to be any solution in Syria without various countries in the region and beyond coming together and really sitting down at the conference table.
That was Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org, and author of several books, including War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Find more news and analysis on the Syrian war by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The concept of distributed energy, that is, energy systems that are small, redundant, and mostly powered by renewable energy, is slowly gaining ground as a response to weather disasters. Distributed energy can also improve resilience in responding to outages caused by climate disruption, as well as cyber and physical attacks targeting a nation's energy infrastructure. Joel Gordis, a Connecticut-based energy security strategist, has for many years been focused on the importance of designing energy systems that are resilient against such threats. He recently testified before the Connecticut Public Utilities Regulatory Authority about the issue. At that hearing, Gordis called on the state to incentivize electric utilities to decentralize the energy grid in exchange for healthy rates of return. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Gordis about the progress being made and the obstacles that remain to make distributed energy, decentralized energy grids, a reality across the U.S.
The problem is, when there's a disaster or something, they concentrate on what the cause of that disaster was, rather than looking at it as an all-hazards approach. In order to do that, you have to look at the following types of problems that can arise. First is a fuel supply interruption with cost escalation going with it. That's happened to us in the past over oil when we were much more dependent on the Middle East. Then there's the physical security of the generation, transmission, distribution, and control systems. And that includes, when I talk about physical security, all forms of natural disasters, including those from climate change. So climate change is just one type of disaster that can take place. Then there's foreign dependency and disruption of globalized supply chains for components and critical materials. For instance, every plant, and every system has to have what are called step-up transformers. Most of these are manufactured overseas and are very large and very difficult to move. So you have the problem of foreign manufacture and the idea that the transport is very difficult. Then cyber threats. Well, this is one of the newest ones, but then again, it isn't. I've been talking about cyber threats since the 90s, and people thought I was a little bit crazy. In fact, the Siting Council here in Connecticut would not let me even use the word until two members intervened to force that to take place. Then there are combined or blended combinations of what I've just mentioned, all the above. For instance, there might be a physical attack accompanied by a cyber attack taking place at the same time. Last of all are what we call unintended consequences. For instance, adding complexity to an already tightly coupled complex system, which is our electric grid, something that takes place in a complex system is if something happens on one end of the grid, in certain instances, it can almost instantaneously have an effect on the other part of the grid due to this complexity. So those are the threats that we potentially face on energy security for the electric grid.
Joel Gordis, how do distributed energy resources address those threats?
Well, right now we have the centralized electric grid. And that's part of the problem, is everything is connected to everything else. And what we need to begin to start doing is decentralizing the electric grid. And that means very specific things. And I still hark back to the guru of decentralization, a fellow named Amory Lovins, who was the co-founder of the Rocky Mountain Institute. And in 1982, he and his then wife, L. Hunter Lovins, wrote a book called Brittle Power, and it was written for the Department of Defense, and then about a year later was released for the general public. This is what Amory and Hunter Lovins basically say, and I totally agree with this, that there should be many small units of supply and distribution. They should be geographically dispersed. They should be interconnected with many units, not dependent on just a few. They should be able to operate if they're in isolated modes. There should be some storage to provide a buffer, so failures tend to be gradual. Short links should be used at the distribution level and employ qualities of user controllability.
Is there any particular kind of energy that lends itself more than others to being used as distributed energy?
Well, basically, there should be many forms of energy. You should have more than one source in a good microgrid. And otherwise, you might have a large solar array. If you have wind capability, some wind, battery storage is what you definitely should have. And even fossil fuel types of small generators to take up any slack when you don't have the wind blowing or the sun isn't shining. So it takes into account a number of different fuels so that you have that capability of running under any circumstance.
Do you see any progress in moving toward distributed energy?
Connecticut has a limited program for what we call microgrids, but it's so limited and so underfunded that they're only doing about, from the beginning till now, and that's about over a four-year period, about seven different projects or so. Hopefully they're going to do more. The military, I think, is pointing the way, and what we learned from their experience can be adapted to the rest of the nation. Now, other states are also engaged in it to different levels. And I don't have a good fix on that, but I think some states may be far more ambitious than what's happening here. So that's something to look at and hopefully start to make an impact. I'm afraid it's going to take some sort of a cyber attack in conjunction with an ice storm or a blizzard to get people thinking of, geez, maybe we really should be doing the decentralization.
That was Joel Gordis, a Connecticut-based energy security strategist. Learn more about the concept of distributed energy systems by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Republican Speaker of the House Paul Ryan recently announced that he won't run for re-election in his Wisconsin home district this November, news that surprised many in Washington. But as he prepares to leave government in the face of a predicted Democratic takeover of the House in the November midterm election, Ryan and his GOP colleagues will be leaving an indelible legacy. The massive tax cut bill they voted for and President Trump signed into law, which disproportionately benefits the wealthiest Americans at a steep cost. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office projects that the cost of the Trump GOP tax cuts will cause the nation's annual budget deficit to top $1 trillion in 2020. The CBO also estimates that the U.S. debt will grow to more than $33 trillion in 2028, almost matching the U.S. gross domestic product, the highest level since World War II. After the tax cut bill passed last December, Speaker Ryan and other top Republican leaders, with no sense of irony, stated that the out-of-control deficit problem that they themselves had created should be addressed by slashing popular federal social safety net programs, including Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, under the guise of what they call entitlement reform. The House has already proposed strict work requirements for food stamp recipients, and those who receive Medicaid benefits in GOP-controlled states could also be subjected to work requirements. Your reporter spoke with Alex Lawson, executive director of the group Social Security Works, who examines the decades-long effort by the Republican Party to raise the eligibility age and reduce benefits for millions of Americans enrolled in the nation's federal social safety net programs.
Yeah, this is one of their oldest tricks. I'll tell you, deficits only matter when Democrats are in power or when the Republicans are coming for your wallet. So when they're talking about these deficits now, they're definitely coming to reach their hand into your pocket and steal your Social Security, steal your Medicare, steal your Medicaid. Look, it's not about deficit or debt. We are the richest nation in the world at the richest point in our history. This is just about political choices. It's a rationale that they're using. But Paul Ryan has fantasized about stealing seniors' money, pushing them into penury and an early grave since college. There's something deeply wrong with that. And yet he's proud of it. He's proud. He's proud that he supports policies that would destroy Meals on Wheels. He's proud that he would destroy Medicaid, the largest provider of long-term care in this country for a huge majority of Americans. He's proud that he would destroy Medicare, which does a far better job of restraining health care costs. So if you were actually caring about any sort of fiscal policies, you would be improving and expanding Medicare to cover everyone. But it's a lie. It's a lie that they care about it. They've never cared about it. They've only got one game. They can dress it up however they want, but it's to reach into our pockets, steal our money, and give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. It's their game. It's what they spent the entire first year trying to pass Trump Care, which just openly destroyed Medicaid, raided Medicare. And remember, they all voted for it. The Republicans are on record voting to raid hundreds of billions of dollars from Medicare, to destroy Medicaid, to cut $1.5 trillion out of Medicaid. When we defeated them on that, they just flipped it. They flipped it with their tax scam, but it's the same thing. Now they've just given our money to their criminal friends on Wall Street, and now they're coming to pick our pockets.
What do we know about what the Trump administration and the Republican-controlled House and Senate are planning to do
regarding cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. What's on the agenda?
They are politically savvy. That's why they pretend it's about deficits. They will dress it up. They're calling it work requirements. Don't be fooled, though. Don't buy the hype. These guys have one game, and it's to destroy systems that help people. That's what they do. So their work requirements, you know how you encourage work? You create jobs. That's what you do to encourage work. How is taking a person who's being treated for cancer, how is taking their medical, their ability to get that treatment for cancer, how is taking that away going to encourage them to work? It's not. It's obviously not. And that's what the work requirement would do. Don't be fooled. That's what they're talking about. See, these guys work for Wall Street. And Wall Street has an enormous amount of money to spend on a bunch of propagandists and spin masters and the like, who will dress up these policies in ways that they sound kind of appealing. Like, oh, yeah, that's about encouraging work. It's not about encouraging work. It's not about encouraging work. If anything, it's a war on poor people. That's what it is. But they're not going to stop there. They hope that people will turn their head when they're only attacking their neighbor. But don't be fooled. They're coming for you next. It's what they always do. And remember, their goal, the crown jewel that they are trying to seize, is the $2.9 trillion held in trust for the American people that is our Social Security trust fund. That is what they just cannot stand that they can't get their hands on. And that's what they're trying to do every single day.
That was Alex Lawson, executive director of the group Social Security Works. Find more analysis and commentary on the Trump Republican Party plan to slash funding for the nation's social safety net programs by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on our newest affiliate, WBDY in Binghamton, New York, WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts, WRGU in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.